This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. There are nearly 7 million fly fishers in the U.S., according to a 2018 survey. Michigan fly fishing enthusiast and author John Osborne is one of them. He's just released a new version of the Fly Fisher's Guide to Michigan, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Lester.
There obviously was a lot of effort to put this guide together. It's a large book, a lot of tips, data, stories about Michigan's fly fishing. How did you become so interested in fly fishing?
Yeah, that's a loaded question, right? I mean, I started out as a young child with my dad and fishing bait and then fishing lures and gradually progressed into fly fishing. And I can really go back to a guy that I went to the police academy with who just introduced it to me and kind of just instilled that passion for fly fishing. And ever since, I've just been going all the time as much as I can.
Help us understand, because you talked about passion. I'm trying to figure out, why are some people so passionate about fly fishing?
You know, fly fishing, it requires an active versus a passive approach. So when you go bait fishing and you put a worm on a hook and throw a bobber out there, you're kind of waiting for something to happen versus fly fishing. Not that there's anything better about it, but you need an active approach. So you need to become a student of the water that you're on, learn the hatches, learn what the fish are eating, if they're eating sculpins or if they're eating mice or if they're eating insects, and learn about those and then tie on your best guess and hope for the best. But I think it's different than just sitting there waiting for something to happen.
Yeah, you talked about making sure you understood what's happening on the river, the different conditions of the river that's essential to fly fishing. So explain that a little bit for us, would you?
Yeah, so for example, right now, we're kind of at the tail end of Hendrickson mayflies. We're going to be working into sulfur mayflies here. And if you're not prepared for that kind of event and you think that you're going to be fishing for something else, if you go out there with hex flies, for example, that's another mayfly that's going to be hatching later, more toward late June, early July, you're just not going to have the best of luck. So you need to read up on that. You need to make sure that you know the size of the flies that you're tying on. And then, you know, what stage the insect is in. Is it in a nymphal stage, or is it emerging, or is it spinning, which is when they're actually laying eggs and dying on the water. And the fish are going to key in on different aspects of that. And a lot of times they're going to just turn their noses up at any other method.
Right. I get the feeling you have to kind of think like a fish too.
Yeah, as much as you can, right.
How does fly fishing in Michigan compare to other states?
Boy, Michigan's got a very rich and longstanding history with fly fishing, there's no doubt. And there's other states that do as well, but Michigan's kind of top of the pile on that whole thing. For example, you were asking, you know, how it differs, but say Montana's going to have more larger average size fish. So if you go out to Montana, you're going to be catching, you know, 14, 15, 16 inch fish all day long. Michigan, you'd be very, very fortunate to do that during the day. That's kind of a banner day when you're catching fish like that. But Michigan also has an incredible nighttime fishery. It's just a different way to fish. You know, you're fishing close to the wood. Some guides call it tickling the wood. You're fishing different aspects of the river, whereas like when I fished in Montana during the daytime, depending on the river that you're on, you may be indicator nymphing, so you're fishing a nymph, a stage of the insect, underneath a float, which is basically just a bobber, and that's completely different than drifting a grasshopper as close as you can to a log jam and hoping some brown trout's going to come out from underneath that log jam and smack the grasshopper imitation that you're working.
Now, you're talking about a lot of flies, and I know that's critical to fly fishing. I interviewed a guy for our Artisans of Michigan series who ties flies for a living. His name's Dennis Potter. I was amazed at the variety of flies. You wrote this book about flies fly fishers use before. And in this book, in the Fly Fisher's Guide to Michigan, you included some popular Michigan flies in it. So why so many flies? Because you're having a, you know, you talked about the different mayflies coming in. Are we talking about all those insects and more?
Yeah, so you know, when we say fly fishing, a lot of times people get the idea that it is only flies, but it's not flies like winged insects that we're talking about. there is that aspect of it, but you know, going back to more of the meaty offerings like crayfish and bait fish and things like that, mice even, you know, frogs. So flies is just a general description that covers all of those lures, for lack of a better word, that you can use to fool fish. And there are so many different flies and so many different popular flies that got their start in Michigan. The Adams, for example, started in 1922. People still fish that thing all the time, and not just in Michigan, but nationally and internationally as well. It's just been a very effective, very popular fly for nearly 100 years now.
We're talking to John Osborne about the new Fly Fisher's Guide to Michigan. The book is just out. So Hemingway has written about fly fishing in Michigan. Presidents have come here to go after coaster brook trouts. Tell me about the history of fly fishing in Michigan.
Yeah, so you hit on Hemingway, which is, he's a biggie, of course. You got Jim Harrison, who's also a very large personality in fly fishing writing. But you also have people like Robert Traver and Jerry Dennis. And then you have artists like Derek DeYoung. His artwork is everywhere. I mean, it's very recognizable. But you also have fly rod makers, and then you also have the Osaba longboat that got its start in Michigan in the late 1800s. And it was built for the logging era to transport tools and supplies up and down the river. But that boat is still in use today. 100 years later, it's still in use, in more than 100 years. It's remained relatively unchanged ever since it got started, and it's just kind of the perfect transportation medium for a river like the Osable.
Right. I understand it's got a really shallow depth. You can go in just a few inches of water.
Yeah, and that's due to the length and the width. I mean, it looks like a long canoe, but it's 23 to 24 feet long. It's only 2.5 feet wide, but very shallow draft, and a guide can stand in there and pull you along in a several inches of water and not scrape bottom.
As I was flipping through the description of Michigan rivers, I couldn't help but remember that a lot of these rivers are polluted with legacy pollutants such as PCBs, dioxin, even DDT. And as we've learned more recently, in rivers such as the Rogue River, the Huron River, the tail end of the Osable, there's PFAS pollution, and this stuff gets into the fish. As someone who enjoys fly fishing around the state, what do you think of these pollution problems?
Yeah, I think that, you know, in short, rivers need friends. And when rivers have advocates and rivers have friends, then those are people that are willing to work to clean up those rivers, because we've done an amazing job of messing them up over the years. And that comes and goes, but you hit on a lot of key points pollution-wise, but it's not something that we can't come back from. Fortunately, rivers are fluid medium. They're always moving. And, you know, if we get to the source of the pollution and deal with that, and then deal with, you know, underlying sediment and things like that where pollutants are lying on the bottom, usually those can come back. But you have all these groups, you know, starting from Trout Unlimited back in 1959, which got its start on the banks of the Osable River in Michigan, to now you have groups like Anglers of the Osable, Friends of the Boyne River, Friends of the Pigeon River. The list goes on and on and on. Those rivers need people advocating for them, lobbying for them, organizing cleanup efforts. Another one is Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, which is a relatively new group, but it's a very exciting group in that it's a very fast-growing organization. They've organized a lot of cleanup projects. Recently, they had one on Portage Creek. They have one on the Rifle River coming up. And they also do pint nights and podcasts, but they've done an amazing job with that, and an amazing job recruiting sportsmen into the sport.
All right, let's hear your 30-second pitch, your most persuasive argument as why someone should try fly fishing if they haven't yet.
Boy, yeah, so if you haven't tried fly fishing, you need to be okay with the fact that it may be a little bit more difficult than other styles of fishing, but the results are extremely satisfying. And patience is a virtue in life, but also in fly fishing. And you have to be able to deal with tangles and getting caught up in trees and getting fish that snub your offering and things like that. But it took me over a year to catch my first trout. When I finally did, I was extremely satisfied, came back just super happy. because it was such a journey to get to that point, to start from the casting and, you know, tying the right knots and finally presenting a fly to the fish where the fish was willing to take it. So I think that you owe it to yourself to give it a try and realize that it may be a little bit difficult, but that you're going to be real happy once it all comes together.
Yeah, you make the point that a great day fly fishing has nothing to do with how many fish you catch. What do you mean by that?
Well, in short, quality over quantity. You know, fish draw us to the rivers and the streams and the lakes, but they really are a relatively small portion of the overall experience. If we take into consideration the wildlife that we see and the birds that we hear and the conversations, deep, meaningful conversations that we have with fellow anglers on the bank, in the end, we realize that fishing brought us there, but the result is not necessarily related to fishing at all. It's interesting because you have people ask you when they find out that you went fishing, they ask you, you know, how did it go? Or, you know, did you catch any fish? How many did you catch? And if you say, oh, you know, I didn't catch a ton of fish or maybe a couple small ones. And then they kind of walk away muttering and saying, oh, whatever you say. I mean, that doesn't sound like a good time to me, but it's a great time. You just need to be open to the fact that there's a lot more going on in fly fishing than just the fish.
I had to laugh. I was reading some of the reviews on Amazon's site about your book. One person wrote, quote, "If you don't buy it, that's your loss. More fish for me." I guess you have fans out there.
It's great to hear that kind of thing. I haven't read that one, but no, that's great. It's that's the kind of person that I wrote the book for sure.
John Osborne is the author of The Fly Fisher's Guide to Michigan. Hey, thanks for telling us about it.
Certainly. Thank you, Lester.